Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
From leading roles in musicals to charting his own path as a performer, Samuel Gaskin has discovered that his real power lies not in chasing stardom, but in creating spaces where his communities feel seen, safe, and celebrated. With roots in Aotearoa and Nigeria and a career spanning music, theatre and intercultural collaborations in Australia, Samuel is committed to joy, healing and unapologetic visibility. The Melbourne-based artist's works Reckoning and Auntie have redefined what representation can look like on stage, mixing ancestral knowledge with pop culture flair. Samuel Gaskin, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me.
Can you set the scene for me? Who was Samuel Gaskin when he was a child?
Oh my gosh. Samuel Gaskin was that kid who was always like at the family gathering, like getting all the cousins together to put on a show and like directing everyone. Like it was non-negotiable. Do you know what I mean? Like everybody had to be involved. Including my auntie's cats. And yeah, was just, I think someone who was always, chasing joy and looking for the fun.
What did some of those performances look like as a child?
Oh my gosh. Well, one of our most world famous performances, was one Christmas, there was this Tarzan and Jane song out. It was by, like, I forget who it was, like some sort of trashy Europop Venga Boys-ish type.
Aqua.
Something like that.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my big brother had to be Tarzan. One of my cousins had to be Jane. I was the funky monkey who could... crump it down and hit the moves. But also, one of my other favourite things to do was push the coffee table up to the TV so that I could be in the music videos at the same time as the artist. there was many, many a lounge room performance back in the day.
So family knew from a very young age that you were always going to be a performer?
I would say so.
Can you take me to the first moment you knew art wasn't just something you did, but something you were?
That's such a beautiful question. I actually think I only had that realization quite recently in terms of like my career. Like I've been doing it for, I don't know, 20 years now. But in terms of like making my own work, Reckoning debuted 5 years ago now, and that was the first time I'd put my own story out there. And I had followed through with a creative idea that I had and followed it all the way through to the end, to putting it on stage at Hamer Hall. And I think it was after that that I had that realization, and that I knew I couldn't be waiting around to be cast in other people's work anymore, because my story and the story of people like me is actually what needs to be told and seen and heard now. Yeah.
How did these childhood performances start becoming a professional pathway for you?
I've always been like super driven and very like interested in how something happens. So I remember there was a girl called Amanda Burt who went to the school near us, and she was on Neighbours at the time. And I was like, she's on Neighbours. I want to be on Neighbours. So I don't know, I must have been 14 or something. And I remember just like asking her all of the questions. And she must have just thought I was so annoying. but she ended up telling me she had an agent, and that's how she got an audition. And I remember like marching home to mum and being like, okay, you need to take me to St. Kilda to Linda's Rising Stars. I'm getting an agent.
Linda's Rising Stars.
Right? I know. That was the actual name too. and it makes me cringe now, but like I cut out like a picture of like myself in like the local paper in like, you know, a school play or Rocker Steadford or whatever the hell it was. And I like took that down with me as like my proof of like, you know, this is why you need this. They just must have like, they must have loved my ambition or just thought, who the hell is this kid who's so ballsy? And yeah, they ended up putting me on their books, and I did like get a little bit part on Neighbours and say three words. And yeah, that was kind of the beginning of realizing that you can do this professionally and even get money from it.
What was that like? You were in primary school. Your dream was to be on Neighbours after seeing this other person on Neighbours. What was it like when you were there?
It was such a weird experience because I loved doing this thing that I had dreamt of for so long, but there's so much more to it than, you know, just rocking up and playing a character. And also, I didn't realize how many layers there are to putting yourself out there like that. I think in my childhood brain, I thought I'd rock up and like be treated like a superstar. And, you know, be taken to my trailer, you know, all that kind of thing. And when you arrive on set and you're just a bit part, you're very much like, you know, the bottom of the ladder. And so there was a lot of sitting around and waiting. And, you know, the fun bit when you actually get to be, you know, behind the camera and do your thing is so small. So yeah, it was eye-opening, but also like very exciting too.
As you were forging your pathway in your career, what were you learning about this industry that you were entering?
Oh my God. As I was forging my pathway, I was learning how whitewashed and racist and homophobic and, just out of touch the industry was, I think. The more I got into it and the more I kind of figured out who was allowed what in terms of, you know, like the jobs and the gigs and that kind of thing, I think it just became really clear to me that there was like a particular box that I was allowed to be in, and it was almost like, you know, don't you dare want more than that, because that's all you can have and all you can be in all your brown, queer fabulousness. Mm. But, yeah, you can do this bit.
Yeah, right. Do you have a story that comes to mind that really displayed this for you?
Oh, gosh. So many. Yeah. So many, but I think what was really interesting for me was, because I'm so stubborn and resilient and kind of refuse to be told that, you know, you're never gonna do X, Y, or Z, the more I pushed through and began to get those gigs and be able to be more visible and take up that space. It was more the reaction I had from different people who weren't to someone like me being in there taking up space that I remember the most. Do you know what I mean? Because I don't accept no's. And I keep going. So, yeah, it was more once I got in there and I started booking these jobs, particularly as a commercial dancer to begin with, which is where I started, I began to notice my peers' kind of reaction to me being given those opportunities and being given that space. One thing in particular I remember was being at a dance class, and I'd begun to book a lot of the commercial dance gigs. So, you know, I was doing music videos for Ricky Lee and working with like Jess Malboy and Guy Sebastian. And, you know, it was like the Idol era when all the Idol kids were like, you know, doing well. So there was like lots of really like big fun gigs for commercial dancers around that time. And I was doing a lot of them as the only brown boy most of the time. And I remember going to a dance class and one of my peers saying to me something along the lines of, oh, I wish I was black with an afro. I'd be doing all those jobs too.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remember like sitting in that for a second and feeling like, oh, hold on a second. Like, I knew for a fact that I was the only one because, you know, when you're young and you're out there, you're looking for someone who looks like you who might be doing a job that you want to do. And then, yeah, to kind of finally be in the mix doing that thing and then have someone say something like that, yeah, it was hurtful, but also like very representative of the way people might say things to, you know, cut you down without, without being super obvious about it, but you know what they mean. And let me tell you, I saw how that boy danced. He wouldn't have been getting those gigs if he looked like me.
How did those experiences shape your desire to tell your own stories?
I think those experiences have definitely pushed the feeling of in me around why it is so important that I'm not just being a representation on stage, that I'm actually sharing my own story and helping others like me share their stories too. Because if there's one thing I've learned, there's something very powerful about seeing yourself and your story represented on stage. I've been shown that over and over again every time I make a new piece of work these days. And, you know, I go out into the foyer after a show and, you know, there's people with tears in their eyes who just want to give me a hug. I'll never forget at Darwin Festival, we took my show Reckoning up to Darwin Festival and someone was like, oh, Barker's outside. They want to meet you. And I was like, Barker, as in like the actual Barker?
How cool.
Yeah. And I was like, okay. And so I walked out and beautiful, beautiful Chloe just had tears in their eyes and gave me a big hug and said, I'm going to cry thinking about it. Said, thank you. I feel like I've just seen my whole story told and represented on stage. And I have so many of those stories. And it's just the most beautiful reminder that I'm doing exactly what I'm meant to.
How do you know when you create an idea like Reckoning, for example, that it's going to become something that you're going to develop?
You know what? I really have just gotten good at listening to my ancestors. they give me the nudges. And I don't know at the time, I didn't know at the time with Reckoning that it was going to become, you know, an award-winning success and we'd be touring for years and, you know, there'd be people like Barker coming to see the show and like, or that Rolling Stone would premiere the single or anything like that. I just knew that I wanted to create this work. I wanted to tell my story, but I also wanted to demonstrate the power of Indigenous mob from across the Moana coming together. I had just been back home to Aotearoa to play a festival with Yothu Yindi and the Treaty Project. I'd written a song with them and they invited me to, you know, go over and sing it at the festival. And I just remember seeing the power of having Indigenous mob together in the same space, let alone when we're creating and performing together too. So the seed for Reckoning really just came from that, me looking for like an excuse to bring mob together. And I just feel like I followed every little nudge that I got from the ancestors all the way to the end of actually like getting the show up on stage. That was the first time I'd done that, you know. I'd always have these brilliant ideas, but I'd half finish them, you know, or I'd play around with it for a bit and then, you know, I'd book a job and then I'd be on contract and I'd forget about it. And I'll never forget I was going for one of the lead roles in Hamilton, which those auditions came up as I was toying around with Reckoning. And I was so sure that I had the gig. Like, you know, it got down to the, you know, when you get down to like the final couple, few actors and you're doing like chemistry tests and that kind of thing, like, the end of the auditions. And I was like, well, I'm the only one here for Lafayette. I guess it's me. And then I got the email to say, sorry, you didn't get the job. And I was so sad. And, you know, that was pretty devastating because I think I did like 6 auditions and callbacks for that show. But not long after that, I remember being like, all right, pick yourself up and get back into Reckoning. You know, you said you were gonna do this Reckoning thing, so get back to it. And as the story goes, if I'd booked Hamilton, I don't think I would have completed Reckoning, you know? And now Reckoning is like my Hamilton. And it's centering my communities and helping share the stories of the people that I want to, you know, center and uplift. So, yeah, everything always works out exactly the way it's supposed to.
Absolutely. Just going back to that moment with Barker, and for those who are listening, Barker is an incredible Indigenous rapper here in Australia. When someone meets you for the first time, what do you hope they feel?
You know, if when someone meets me for the first time, I just hope they feel comfortable. And I hope they feel seen. Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Yeah. You describe yourself as a creator and change agent. What does that actually feel like inside you?
It feels like doing exactly what I was put here to do. It feels like making my ancestors proud. It feels like healing all the parts of myself that I tried to push away when I was younger because they made me different. And it feels like creating things that might just help other people be able to do that too.
How empowering is that to feel all of those feelings that, you know, you probably were shy or ashamed of or anything growing up because you were different, to now have that as your power?
It's been a journey, and I think, you know, like whilst I did try and push those parts of myself that made me different, away growing up, I think a big part of my journey has been learning that those things that I tried to push away are actually my superpowers and are actually what make me unique and actually what give me the depth that I carry. And so, yeah, it feels amazing. It sometimes feels overwhelming too, because I do feel like I'm representing for a whole bunch of little Sams and making room for them too. But, yeah, I wouldn't have it any other way.
How has your community shaped your sense of self?
I think my community's helped shape my sense of self by embracing me for simply being who I am, and giving me the space to feel comfortable enough to not need to mask or adjust myself to be palatable, if that makes sense. Yeah, I think growing up in very white Australia, as a person of colour, a queer person of colour at that, you know, you learn to, in certain scenarios, edit yourself to not draw too much attention or get yourself into a situation that might be uncomfortable. And I think what my communities have given me is the support and the love to just be who I am, unapologetically who I am. And from that, I've gained the confidence to actually just go out into the whole damn world and be unapologetically who I am.
Why do you think it's so important for you to embrace being queer, black, a father, and show pride in each of those identities?
I think it's so important because I wish that I knew someone as cool as me when I was young and growing up. And do you know what I mean? Looking for that reflection, you know? And I just didn't have it, not in media, not in my real life. Yeah, I think back to, like, even who was on television then, like, in terms of, you know, like, black people, and it was, like, Jay LaGaia and Ernie Dingo and maybe Marsha Hines every now and then. And shout out to them. Love them all and appreciate the space that they were able to take up then. But I didn't resonate with any of them in terms of who they were as people, you know. I feel like grateful, like at least I got to see someone with brown skin on TV taking up that space. But, yeah, nobody who felt like me.
You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber and I'm speaking with Samuel Gaskin. You often bring people together who might never otherwise meet. What do you think happens in those moments of connection?
Ooh, I think those moments of connection are like the most magic. Like, it's, to me, that's the most exciting thing for me, is feeling the energy of creativity bubble away between people who just probably wouldn't have ended up in the same room. Like, for instance, with the Reckoning Project, I was really keen to have Indigenous singer-songwriters from Aotearoa and from so-called Australia in the same room as a sound healer and a pop music producer. So, like, in our first session, it was me, the Marindas, and Katie Underwood, who Katie Underwood used to be in Bardot. She was like, remember that show, Pop Stars?
Yes.
And then she like left the industry completely, like turned her back on it and became a sound healer. So it was her and Pip Norman. And like, I remember like looking around the room and being like, whoa, like not only could you feel the ancestors being like, yes, you better get it. but like you could just feel this really beautiful, exciting energy, and you knew something cool was about to happen. And I have that on the regular, and so much so that I think that's something that I'm always looking to do now when I'm creating a new work. I think in Australia, like, we're very good at like doing the same thing over and over again and seeing the same thing over and over again, because it's like, I don't know, we like a tried and tested method or something like that. And for me, like what's exciting is doing something that hasn't been done before. You know, that's what I find exciting, and that's where the energy draws me in. Mm.
What do you want your children to see when they see you create?
I want my children to see me having fun. I want my children to see me creating unapologetically and not worrying about the outcome, just really being in that moment of creativity and enjoying that. And hopefully I want them to see a bit of inspiration to get out there and share their hearts and their art with the world. Yeah.
Are you seeing any performances on tables, coffee tables in front of the TVs as yet with your children?
Oh, my God, so many. So many from the get-go. Like, yeah, they can rock a coffee table lounge room. Let me tell you. I'm so happy Rayla's made it through her comedy era, though. Like, she had this, like, phase where, like, she would do comedy shows and she thought she was, like, really funny. And, you know, like, the jokes weren't landing. But let me tell you, she can sing. She can sing. She can sing and she can act. And she is actually pretty funny in her normal everyday, you know, life, but the comedy era was not giving comedy. I never forget my friend Michaela Bannis was over, and Michaela's like amazing comedic actor, right? Like, she did Upward Middle Bogan and all of those things. And Rayla was like, okay, I'm going to do a comedy show. And I was like, yeah.
When the lights go down and the applause fades, what lingers for you?
How important it is to connect with one another on a deep level. How important it is to be as authentically yourself as you possibly can. If there's something in your heart that is creative and exciting and you're not looking at it, have a little look and be brave enough to give it a go and follow it all the way through to the end, because, yeah, you might just surprise yourself and you might just end up exactly where you're meant to be.
Samuel, thank you so, so much for joining me from Melbourne and for sharing your journey from chasing the dream of stardom to creating works that heal, celebrate and transform communities. That was Samuel Gaskin, creator, performer and change agent. Thank you, Samuel.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To hear more stories about unique and incredible people from the Pacific, just search for Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. If you or someone you know has an interesting story to share, you can email us at storiesfromthepacific@abc.net.au. This story was produced on the lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people. I'm hosting this story on the lands of the Kaurna people.